Hello, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Why Theory. As always, I am your host, Ryan Angley, joined, as always, by co-host Todd McGowan. Todd, how you doing, buddy?
Ryan, great to talk to you today.
Good to talk to you as well. And today, we are talking about, we're returning to our series of going through his seminars, and I think we made the decision, with no disrespect at all to seminars 3 through 6, because we've been doing...
I think we did three.
Okay. Four through six.
So it's four through six.
Four through six. No disrespect whatsoever. Because we've been doing this Kantian thing, he says knowingly, we're going to go into Seminar 7, which is a very, very Kantian moment for Lacan. And so kind of going to show how Kant works in Lacan's theorizing in this moment, but also to really get into this seminar because it's, I think it's the one that we've probably talked about the most throughout the show's history. We've talked
through
about
episodes that were on different kinds of things, right? Like that weren't necessarily on it directly, but.
I mean, we had one on dusting. Did we not have one on sublimation? I'm sure that we did.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and Death Drive, which is in here, and the maxim, what do we call them? The aphorism.
Oh, yeah, the aphorism.
Don't give ground relative to your desire. So I think, I think this seminar has been really almost ubiquitous. And I don't think we're outliers on that. I think people that write on Lacan tend to talk about this seminar. And Seminar 11, which we're going to do next, they tend to talk about it more than the other ones. So I think we're normal in that sense. It's not a minority report.
Not a minority report, no. And this is the question that we're going to be looking at, which is, does this explain everything or does it explain nothing? Because that it's really fascinating. Like this is, I don't know. It's hard for me to, think about another thinker who has a work that is quite like this one, that has a place quite like this in the field. Where, I mean, and I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but like in the moment of me saying this statement, I can't think of it. And it is not to say that this is divisive. That would be very, very important to lay out. This is not a divisive seminar whatsoever.
Right.
I think you've got a lot of people who find that the explanatory weight of this, it outstrips almost any of the other seminars. I think friend of the show, friend in real life, Rick Boothby, I think he gives a lot to this, and he's not the only one. And then I think, you know,
former friend of the show, Mari Rudy, thought the same thing. Right?
It's friend of the show, Todd. That's in perpetuity.
I know. I she didn't stop being a friend.
Of course not. But yeah, she loved this. I mean, The Call of Character, great book by her. Excuse me, knowingly indebted to this book, to its project, and taking the ethical project that Lacan lays out here and making one of more, like, you know, Mari's like incredible genre of non-self-help books. Like she was able to do that there. And then I think, not to immediately out your position, but then you got someone like you who thinks that this is this is rife with hapaxes and things that don't occur elsewhere. And it's on that basis that it's significant, but it can't be rolled into, it can't be easily rolled into being a synecdoche for Lacan as such because of these moments. Is that a fair characterization?
I think it's absolutely true. I think you can almost say, right there, I don't think you could... So the big ones are, Seminar 2 is a pretty big, you could maybe call it something like the Big Other Seminar, right? Like it's the real articulation of the early position. And then there's Seminar 7, which, as you rightly pointed out, it's a hapax. It's like, it's almost as if the word hapax was invented just to define this seminar, because there are so many things in it, we're going to talk about this, that come here once and then are gone, or they're defined in a way here once and then they're defined never the same way before and never the same way afterward. There's an aphorism that is Lacan's most famous that is used here one time and then never appears again. Yeah. So there are all these incredible one-offs which is of course the definition of a half-ex. And so it's interesting that it's the one that people know the most. I think it's fair to say it's the most philosophical. Sure. I think that's right. Like the Kantian philosophy is there, but it's also the one and most philosophically rigorous. I think it might be the clearest also, which is an advantage for why people like to read it. And then I would say, so I think there are Seminar 7 Lacan people like Rick and Mari, and then there are Seminar 11 people. Like I would include myself. I would include, I think you're in that group. I think Slavoj's in that group. And then I think there are Seminar 20. I think Alenka's in that group. Mm-hmm. I think our friend Sheldon George is in that group. Mm-hmm. And then I think there are Seminar 20 people, and I'm going to, I mean, I don't know if she wants to be there, but I think Joan Kopchak, to me, is more in that group. And I think, interestingly, almost everyone in France is in that group. Jacqueline Miller is in that group, to my mind. I think a lot of the practicing analysts that we know are influenced much more by especially the Seminar 23 and the development of the Santone way to effectuate the cure. And so I think that they're more drawn to that. But I think theoretically, because probably of Slavoj, I think the Seminar 11 people have probably, that is maybe the dominant emphasis. But I think Seminar 7 is just, it's tempting not to just fall for it when you're reading it, don't you think? I was rereading it for today and I just was like, wow, it's like, there are just so many formulations that are just great. And he's kind of likable here in a way that he's, you know what I mean? Like in a way that he's not in the other, like in Seminar 11, even he's funny here. He's not so as funny. And I guess he's still funny at points in Seminar 11, but I don't know. He was, you know, he's in his mid-50s. I'm in my mid-50s. I feel a little like he was probably, you know, he's like towering above me as an intellect, but you know, we're at the same point in life. I could imagine talking in the way that he does and trying, like, it seems like he prizes accessibility here in a way that he's not gonna in 10 years.
Right? Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, so this is like my kind of attempted, my split the baby take, if I'm gonna to call it something, is that I think the seminar does explain everything, and it's because it explains so much so clearly that Lacan pivots to be a little more elusive after this. That's my thing. Like I think that this there's
look at where clarity got me.
But he even brings that up. Like I don't know that I see him do this later, but he says, oh, people, what is this? He says this early that, he says this a couple different times that people will say that Lacan doesn't say anything more complicated than the king has no clothes. I think he brings that up a couple different times. And there's like a couple different, like I would call it in a very normative sense of meaning this, is these self-conscious remarks that what he says is not complicated enough. He said that this comes up like in the intro to the different lectures a couple different times. And I don't know that I'm sure that it does happen later, but it seems like that's more of a point here. So he's, because of that.
This is also the seminar, Ryan, where he, sorry to interrupt, where he says, don't try not to understand too quickly, right?
Like,
you think you understand, you don't understand. So he's really conscious of that point that you're making, I think.
You can see it everywhere. And I think that you can also see it in like the depth of clarity that pervades this particular text. I do think like it's, you know, not for nothing. It's a little bit like for the ones that Norton put out that are in paperback, like it's thicker, I think, this is a thicker book than as a collection than Seminar 11. I think by some, I don't know, maybe 100 pages, not that, but there's more here. And it's, I think that it's tighter and in a way that, I mean, it's very complimentary. Like it is plainer in meaning throughout. Yeah. And I think in a meaningful sense, I think he's not Lacan yet. Like he's not the memeable Lacan, I'll put it that way. The one who was this, the performance that we think of when we think of Lacan. I don't think that had happened yet. And it certainly hadn't influenced the way that he explained things yet. Like, I just, again, I think that there's, as we're going to go through, I think there's a clarity in this text with a lot of ideas. And part, you know, I think part of the bargain was you got this clarity and then he moved off of those positions and he moved somewhere else. So that's my sort of like meta reading of its place in his work.
I think that's really good. I think that nicely explains the appeal. Like, it's almost like he gives his interlocutors a vanishing object. Right? Like, like, you get a little, and I think that's it. There's interesting to think about that alongside the idea of Das Ding, because Das Ding is itself inaccessible. It is inaccessibility itself, right? Yeah. So the fact that he presents it and then basically hides it, he brings it up like four or five times subsequently, only in the most elliptical ways, never for more than a few sentences of text at a time. So he really introduces an idea here and then either abandons it totally or more or less abandons it, right? And I think it fits that idea of the elusiveness of the object and that wait a minute, what did I do? I was too clear here. All these people are going around like, I understand Lacan. We can't have that. I'm going to subsequently change the path, right? Mm. And I'll create this obscurantist that he became at the end, right? Like, I think that there is something to that, really.
Yeah. I mean, so we're going to go talk about Seminar 11 after this one. And I think that there are, like, you have to say, just taking that premise seriously, like, either your explanation can differ for why he doesn't come back to some of these ideas or even some of these explanations of some of these ideas. What I think can't really be argued is, like, I mean, there are real gains, like, theoretically, from him making that move for whatever reason he did it. And I mean, we'll get to some of those in 11. I think there is something with Abjaya, for example, that is not in Das Ding, and it is worthwhile. You know, and it is interesting too, because he has this, you can almost see this like an anticipation of it, because he says in this seminar that there's not, he doesn't have a French phrase that seems to capture what he wants in Das Ding. There's that line earlier somewhere, and he just puts it out to the crowd, like, maybe someone will be able to give it to me. And I don't think that is what led to Abjaya, but it is just kind of interesting that he put that out there and as maybe looking for something in French to capture what he was thinking rather than in German and leaving it in another language. I think that's there. But anyway, speaking about, I was going to say just that what is interesting and about this text, as we've been saying, is that it does encapsulate and summarize a number of different things, or at least intersect with a number of things that had been important to the prior seminars. But then there are also these breaks that are largely unanticipated by the prior work. And so let's start with one of those. Let's start with the break of Das Ding.
Yeah, let's start with that. I mean, wow, it's a pretty big... So first of all, what does he mean by that? Well, he means this void, right? Like, basically a void that draws in our desire, but it's called Das Ding, which is the German term for the thing, but it's really a no thing, right? Or a not thing. And I think that's really important for him, that it's not... And his examples of Das Ding, one of the favorite examples he gives is of Jacques Prévert's collection of matchboxes, right? Like, the matchbox, and he also talks about the vase, because the vase is this thing around an emptiness, and the Das Ding is not the vase itself. It's the hole in the middle of the vase. It's the Das Ding of the matchbox is the empty space within the matchbox, and so I think that for him, that idea that there is an absence that our desire is drawn to and not a presence is really important. Now, the other question is why the German, you alluded to this, like, why the German were dusting and why not the French la chose, right? Which just means the thing. And he will sometimes say la chose and it gets translated as the thing. And usually it's capitalized to make the distinction. Although he, again, he's speaking this, so that wouldn't have been, he didn't say, oh, capital C la chose.
Right.
So that is Jacques Alain Miller's, I think, correct, but it is his intervention. It's not something from the spoken that would have been evident from the spoken text. What I would say is that German, unlike both French and English, allows for this. So German has two words for thing, das Ding, which we've been saying, and die Sache, which is also the thing. So it's not like thing and object, because there's actually, interestingly, two words in German for object, Objekt, and Gegenstand. So that's also, so you could have done the same thing with objet a and called it the die Gegenstand or something, right? Like if he wanted to. But I think he found exactly what you're talking about, right? He felt this kind of, let's make this a French, I don't want to have to rely on German when I do my next big concept. So I'm going to create it. I'm going to just call it this objet. So, and insist that it not be translated. So, but Das Ding is often translated. I don't think there's an issue with the translation of that. But anyway, I think he likes that idea that German has the two words and one, I think, isn't this right? That one is symbolic and one is real, right? One, like die Sache is the symbolic form of the thing and Das Ding is this real form of it. But we got to get into how he thinks of the real here, because that's pretty fascinating too.
Yeah. So we'll come back to Dustin, because it's going to obviously if you know, it'll dominate a lot of the conversation moving forward. But it is important to get into Lacan's very famous three orders. He refers to them as the three orders here of imaginary, symbolic, and real. And we're still not at a point where, and I don't think it'll be until 11, I would say, that the real is the way most people think about it who know Lacan.
I think by 9 it's clear.
By 9 it's clear.
Okay. Yeah. Because he identifies object. 9 is where objet a is invented. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, 9 has not even appeared yet in French. So Miller has not yet edited that, although he's going rapidly. So Seminar 14 just came out in French, and Seminar, which is Logic of Fantasy, and then Seminar 15, which is Psychoanalytic Object. Psychoanalytic Act. They just came out. So he's kind of working. I think he's feeling Time's winged chariot at his back, right? He's feeling like he has to get them out, or else someone else is going to do it. And I think he doesn't like the idea that he'd be dead and someone else would do it. Anyway, 9 is still not out. But that's where objet a is invented, and I think that's when this switch to what we think of as the real in Lacan's sense first emerges. So the go idea ahead. Of the, sorry, I interrupted this, you.
Yes, no, I appreciate that. Like, and what I mean by that is the like this impossible whole and the symbolic. What he says in this one is pretty good. Is that what's the, help me if I'm slightly misquoting this, but it's the real. I don't know if he says the thing, but the real is the thing that is always in the same place.
Yes.
That's how he defines it here. Yeah. And there's still this tether.
It's aligned with reality, Ryan.
Yeah, I was just about to say this. There's this tether to reality, which is something that is one of the reasons why Seminar 3 happened, which we would have talked about in the podcast that I apparently forgot that we recorded. So we clearly would have talked about that, because that's the whole thing. So yeah. Here it's not just reality as such, but it is reality principle. So there's this tie between real and reality principle in this that is, for a later Lacan, a post Seminar 9 Lacan, it's a way of understanding the real that evaporates and is very much against what he's trying to do with the idea of like the real as this unarticulatable space of roiling trauma, I'll put it that way.
Right.
From the trauma of the everyday to the trauma that prevents you from leaving the house or getting out of bed, like that. Right. That kind of that's not how he means it here. It's just not here yet.
Can I ask you a question? Like, why can you make sense for me of how he links dusting and the real to reality principle? Because, and just how that's a reading of Freud, because for Freud, isn't Freud very clear that reality principle is just a compromise of the pleasure principle because of the exigencies of the social reality?
Yeah. Right? To extend the pleasure, actually.
Right. Because yeah. I would find it pleasurable if I went and shot my neighbor, but I'm sorry for that. That's unconscious. What is my neighbor? I hope they're not listening. But I would find it pleasurable, but I can't do that. So instead, I'm just going to go and like key my neighbor's car and like dump garbage, throw some garbage out of their garbage can, do all these little
you're short with them in the when you speak.
Yes,
to them.
I'm curt with them. Right, yeah. Right. So I'm obeying. That's the reality principle, right? Like, mm-hmm. But that's how is that dusting? And I just like I thought shouldn't dusting be beyond the pleasure principle?
Yeah.
And like here isn't Lacan confusing reality principle with death drive in some weird way? I have a hard time. I've never understood this. And Rick Boothby, who loves this seminar, I've talked to him numerous times and he tried to explain it to me. And I guess I'm just too, I can't get it. I'm just too dense. Part of it is that as you pointed out, this is completely gone in any later discussion of Lacan, this idea of reality principle, right?
Yeah.
Or this idea of death drive.
So, okay. This is tough because his idea of reality principle in so I guess you have to do this is you have to so what is Lacan's reality principle? Can we start there? Let's start there.
Yes. Yeah.
What's Lacan's reality principle in this seminar? And I think it is something that is more I think it's more active and it is more it's more negotiable than it is for Freud. I don't want to go immediately to he puts the beyond of the pleasure principle in the reality principle because I think I agree with that. But because your question is like how does Lacan understand? And this is a big thing with the seminar because we've said many times on the podcast before, and we're not going to get back into this. But like Lacan sometimes shows us that he's not a very good reader. Like the whole thing with Antigone, who says that she's following the unwritten rule of the gods, that is just not in his account of
Antigone. He doesn't care about that.
He doesn't care about, well, because it undercuts this idea that right. she's not giving right. ground relative to desire. Like it is her own desire to transgress Creon's law, but she's saying she's following a higher law, which is kind of interestingly in this very, which we haven't even gotten into any of this, but in this very Kantian seminar is like a real Kantian move from her. Lacanian move. Yeah. It's more of a, so anyway, right. we're yeah. going to put the Lacan and maybe not reading exactly to the letter as we might want. So what is he actually, do you have a quote ready to go? Like for reality principle that is that works for this, and maybe we can kind of work our way backwards.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I just like it's not clear to me where he ever articulates exactly what he thinks the reality principle is. But I do know that he does link it. Mm-hmm. Like when he starts to talk about Das Ding, he does link it to the reality principle, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So here's the problem, right? Like dusting clearly is beyond the pleasure principle, right? Like
he says it's a
beyond. It's identified with jouissance, right? Like an impossible jouissance, an impossible enjoyment, right? So that's why it's just confusing to me that gets linked to, and I think he again abandons that. Like I think this is in the first dusting chapter. He says, "I would like today to show you that this ding in life and in the reality principle that Freud introduces at the beginning of his thought and that persists to the end." So this is what he wants to show. So he clearly says that Das Ding is what we have in the reality principle. So I'm not sure. I don't know what to do with that. I mean, other than to just like go on, because it just seems like, so, like that, how can that possibly, like, it's this thing. Okay. I guess, you know, reality is what we stumble over, right? Mm-hmm. In this period of Lacan's thought, right? Like reality is what is returns to the same place, whereas the symbolic is constantly shifting. Yes. Mm-hmm. So we stumble over the real or reality. And maybe we stumble over Das Ding, but then doesn't that, here's the problem that for me, and this will get to the next thing that we want to talk about, is that he links Das Ding to sublimation.
Yeah.
And sure. So I don't see how reality principle has anything to do with sublimation. Like my example of like the neighbor, like, okay, I guess like, have I elevated the neighbor to the status of Das Ding, which is why I want to shoot the neighbor, right? Like maybe that's true. I like all my neighbors, by the way. This is the only reason I came with that example. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it doesn't, like, maybe that's the link, right? Like, that there has to be this act of sublimation that the real and reality emerge through that. But that seems, I don't know, that seems to contradict the idea of reality principle as Freud understands it, for sure.
So I'm going to try to read, this is a lot.
It's, okay, you try to do it.
Early. I'm going to give this to you, and I think anyway, I think this is pretty good. He gives this. It is, so you're just going to have to deal with the fact that you don't know what it is refers to. Listener, I'm very sorry, but, and also Todd. So it is a movement which makes him, Freud, start with a first opposition between reality principle and pleasure principle in order, after a series of vacillations, oscillations, and imperceptible changes in his references, to conclude at the end of theoretic formulations by positing something beyond the pleasure principle that might well leave us wondering how it relates to the first opposition. Beyond the pleasure principle, we encounter that opaque surface, which to some has seemed so obscure that it is the antinomy of all thought, not just biological, but scientific in general, the surface that is known as the death instinct. What is the death instinct? What is this law beyond all law that can only be posited as a final structure, as a vanishing point of any reality that might be attained? In the couple, and I mean, I hope, listener, you can tell, I mean, it's difficult, but there is a clarity to the way that he's writing. What we're trying to suss out is the connective tissue of the concept. So anyway, in the coupling of pleasure principle and reality principle, the reality principle might seem to be a prolongation or an application of the pleasure principle, which is what I said a few minutes ago.
That's what Freud thinks.
And that's what Freud, yeah. But on the other hand, this dependent and limited position seems to cause something to emerge, something which controls in the broadest senses of the whole our relationship to the world. It is this unveiling, this rediscovery that Beyond the Pleasure Principle is about. And in this process, this progress, we see before our eyes the problematic character of that which Freud posits under the term reality. It is a question of daily reality, of immediate social, is it a question of daily reality, of immediate social reality, of conformity to established categories or accepted practices, of the reality discovered by science, or the one which is yet to be discovered? Is it psychic reality? It is on the road to the investigation of this reality that we find ourselves as analysts, and it leads us a long way from something that can be expressed under the categories of wholeness. It leads us into a special area, that of psychic reality, which presents itself to us with a problematic character of a previously unequaled order. I will therefore begin by attempting to explore the function of that the term reality played in the thought of the inventor of psychoanalysis, and at the same time in our own thought, the thought of those who have followed in his path. So I'm going to cut it off there. But he does mention that moral action poses problems for us precisely to the extent that if analysis prepares us for it, it is also in the end leaves us standing at the door. So he also wants to put morality in this, and that's
okay.
You can see a continuum.
Yeah.
So
good.
Page 2021, your reaction, Todd McGowan.
Yeah, I think that's pretty. I think that's not a bad. That's not a bad explanation, really. Right? Like isn't his point here? That just to break it down, like, isn't his point just that this actual opposition between reality principle and pleasure principle, like the very positing of a reality that is outside the pleasure principle, actually creates what he calls this opacity mm-hmm. of Das Ding that then is what moves us in the beyond of the pleasure principle.
Yeah.
So I think that's that it's almost like a, isn't it kind of, it doesn't exactly work this way, but isn't mm-hmm. I think that this, obviously this is not how Hegel's thought works, but isn't it kind of like a thesis synthesis and or thesis antithesis synthesis move, right? Like
yeah,
that,
sure.
Although the Das Ding isn't any kind of synthesis, but it's like there's a nice triplicity that he sees at work, right? There's mm-hmm. in the one, out of the dialectical conflict of the one, it's almost like this offspring emerges,
sure.
which is Das Ding, that then yeah. moves to the beyond the pleasure principle. Yeah. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I guess it's just not how I would, I don't think he will subsequently think, in fact, I know he won't, that it's through this dialectic of pleasure principle and reality principle that this beyond emerges, right? Because
yeah.
the problem is that he doesn't see the way in which the beyond is within. And I think that mm-hmm. if there's one problem we were talking about, you said we were going to talk about the Kantian dimension of the seminar, right? Like if there's one problem with the seminar from beginning to end, it's that it posits a beyond all the time,
mm-hmm.
right? Like the Das Ding is beyond, sublimation creates a beyond, the ethics of psychoanalysis creates a beyond, like the desire mm-hmm. is organized around a beyond, we're beyond the service of goods, everything is about this transcendent beyond. And then, so thus, the Kantian term of the thing in itself, das Ding an sich, is I think really the, what would you call it, the nodal point mm-hmm. of Lacan's discovery of, his own discovery of Das Ding. So I think there's an influence of, Heidegger wrote an essay called Das Ding that is weighing over this. And as Lacan points out, Freud in the Project for a Scientific Psychology mentions right. Das Ding as well. So there is these other things influencing it. But my contention would be that it's fundamentally a Kantian idea that mm-hmm. he has here. And I think it's, again, this idea of a beyond that organizes our entire desire. And you made a nice point about this Kantian dimension to me personally, but why don't you say it? Because I think it fits here with what Lacan is trying to do. Kantian terms, right?
Can you tell me what I said? Because this is one of the...
I can, yeah.
Listen, I'm not doing a bit. I just don't remember.
yeah, that's fine. You're not doing a bit. It's too bad. You could have...
I know. This happens in class all the time.
What you said was...
Okay, yeah,
good. I don't want to take your...
No,
your
I know. I know what you're doing.
I think this is a great point.
That okay.
You said to me, look, it's... Lacan is really trying to do what, like Fichte tried to do it, what other thing they tried to do, but not so much success. He's trying to marry the theoretical Kant with
the practical
Kant,
yes.
But in a way that's completely opposite of Fichte, Hegel, and Schelling. So the rest of the German idealists, they're basically, they Kant writes Critique of Pure Reason, and they're like, wait a minute, this thing in itself doesn't make any sense because you say you can't know anything about it, yet you know all these things about it. So we got to junk that. And Lacan says, wait a minute, I'm going to take the one, but I'm going to keep, they all thought, we're going to keep the practical philosophy because that's pretty great, mm-hmm. right? So what does Lacan do? He says, like, I'm going to junk the theoretical philosophy. I'm going to take this one concept in it. It's not even a concept. This one idea from it, the Ding an sich, the mm-hmm. thing in itself. And I'm going to take that and bring that together with the practical. Whereas Fichte's whole point is, I'm going to bring the practical and theoretical together by getting rid of the thing in itself.
Yeah.
Right? So see, it's a kind of interesting way that what he's doing there, right? Like it's really, I think it's unique. And again, this is the incredible nature of this seminar. I find it, I'm not a devotee of it, but I just find it so... What would you call it? Like alluring, like it's just seductive almost. It's just first one thing, there's way too many ideas here. There's way too many ideas for a single, like this is like five. If someone came to you with this, you'd say, well, wait a minute, you have like seven seminars here or you have seven books. I always say this to you, like, right? You're like, that's not one book, man. That's, you've got three books there or something.
Yeah. You did this to me with my master's thesis, if I recall.
Right. Yeah. Right. So but that's true. I mean, it's never been more true of a thing than this thing. But I think the Kant thing is really interesting, right? That he's, just like you said, like this, taking this maybe worst idea from the first Critique of Pure Reason and marrying it with this really, which we'll get into, the practical moral Kant from the Critique of Practical Reason, because that's the whole, his ethics of psychoanalysis is really an attempt to think out the Kantian ethics in a slightly different way, but not totally reject it.
So thank you. I do remember saying this after you started to explain it. We can't jump to it now, but like the good serves as a protection against jouissance, right? And that's which is what enables jouissance to be articulatable for Lacan in this seminar, in this moral way, and that's an interesting.
Yeah,
that's an interesting way of bringing Kant into this whole
Kantian morality.
Yeah, right? Whole thing. Yeah, it is interesting, and I mean, I think what I suppose you can say that he agrees a little bit with the other German idealists because he does try not to articulate what's in the beyond, but by making the beyond so much a part of this project, he's trying to draw it out from Kant's theoretical project just in different ways. And and so that you just, and you might, it's kind of funny that he doesn't, he talks about sublimation and he doesn't, I guess, I don't know. I never think of his theory of sublimation as a theory of the sublime. I think that I just don't think about them together that way, because I think that, but I do think that even though he doesn't talk about, like, I think it would be a confusion in terms, this sublime experience of the inaccessible, this, like, you're just overcome with your inability to express. I think he's trying to come up with different avenues where that can exist in both everyday material life and in psychic life. So I think he's trying to, I do think he's trying to grant the beyond a substance that makes it more apprehendable and maybe like away from the critique of the other German ideas. Like, how can you say that we can't talk about it and yet you talk about it while still preserving a beyondness to the beyond, if that makes sense.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think but I think that's why someone like really committed Hegelians, I think, find, like Slavoj, for instance, like they find this seminar frustrating for that reason.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because it does insist on this thing that it's a non-relation.
Yeah.
It's a non-relation. Yes. It has no dialectical connection to the subject, right? So sublimation is not about, it's interesting when you said that about the sublime, it made me think of the third critique of faculty of judgment. And then I thought, well, maybe he's actually bringing all the three critiques together here. And that's the discussion of sublimation, right? Like that, that there is, although I think Kant thinks this too, that, like Kant says, what is it that fills me with wonder? It's the starry heavens above me and the moral law within, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the idea is that the moral law, there's a sublime quality to the moral law within as well as the beauty of the natural world. And I think I think Kant convinces Lacan of that, right? Mm. What Lacan is trying to do is link our capacity to sublimate to our moral or ethical being, right? Like, I think that's one of the things. Now, he doesn't provide a lot of the connective tissue, which is a really frustrating thing about this seminar. But I think both things are in here, right? There is like, there's clearly, after he gets done with the discussion of Das Ding, which then, okay, it persists a little bit because you have this thing on neighbor love and what we're afraid, why Freud backs away from love of the neighbor is he's afraid of the Das Ding of the neighbor, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's, Das Ding is still there. It's there in the courtly love discussion. And then it's kind of gone. Right. It's there in the sublime. It's there in the sublimation. The idea of when he describes sublimation is the sublimation raises an ordinary object to the dignity of dusting. Right.
That's, so it's there. And that's a direct quote, by the way. That's like that another key line of clarity from this. If you want to say
how has that not been an aphorism of ours?
Seriously. Like, that's, that's a good point.
Yeah. So that's so all these incredible lines that he has here, all these incredible ideas. So that's like toward the beginning, we're still toward the beginning of the seminar. and but then Das Ding basically, I think I wrote in a little essay on Seminar 7, it's in a collection from, I think, Carol Owens and Stephanie Swales. I think I have a little section called Das Ding's Disappearing Act, right? And it's like, it's not just that it disappears in Lacan's later seminars, it disappears here, right? Like it basically, it does not, you're like, okay, Ethics of Psychoanalysis, Das Ding is introduced, it's a big deal made about it, it gets two sections, right? According to Blair's nomenclature. So it's a big deal, it's a big deal, it's a big deal. And then we get to Splendor of Antigone and the analysis of the play, and then there's nothing.
Yeah.
Right? It's a very strange, we're not going to get there yet because we have to go through a couple more things, a couple more detours on the way, but it's like, it does disappear. And it's just, I don't know. What's interesting, I think what Rick Boothby would say, I mean, we had him on, he did an episode on this. It was way at the beginning of our whole recording these podcasts. That I think what he would say is, well, Lacan has this incredible insight and then he kind of backs, it's almost like the trauma of Das Ding is too much for him, right? And he backs away from his own greatest insight. And and every subsequent work, even subsequent session of the seminar is this retreat from the horror of the encounter with Das Ding.
Well, that's why I think that's what it explains too much. Like that's why I think that he found something that explains too much about his own thought and has to make these detours. I would say just on my separating this like experience of I mean, Freud says this in like the, I don't know, the third sentence of the Uncanny essay is that, you know, most writing on the sublime has to do, co-equates it with a theory of beauty. And what he wants to write in the Uncanny is a theory of I tend to read it as like a theory of horror and he doesn't phrase it that way exactly, but his examples are, you know, from things that have influenced horror, so you know, maybe it's not an inapplicable thing. But if you want to tell me, I don't mean you personally or specifically, that what sublimation is here is a sublime of the mundane object, then I think I think I can buy that, but it's not. I don't think it's his point to make an intervention into the sublime. I think that's
yeah.
My
no,
thing.
I agree with yeah, that. Yeah, I agree with that. But I do like that idea of a sublime, the sublime of the banal or something.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Like the sublimity of the banal.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do think, because he makes a point when he's talking about courtly love to say that this was the epoch of courtly love poetry was also an epoch of the degradation of women.
Yeah.
Right? Like he's like, don't get confused. This is not feminist poetry, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's that fits into the point, right? Like it's the elevation of this figure that's been denigrated, right? Not a something that's already like the starry heavens above.
Right.
I think that's really, I do think that is the part of the theory, but I more or less agree with you that he's not, this isn't a theory of the sublime. Mm-hmm. It's a theory of sublimation.
I think he puts
the act, it's the act of the subject, right? Like that, that creates this. I mean, there's a whole question, I think, that he doesn't address of whether students ask me this all the time. Other people ask me this, like, can you consciously sublimate? Like, do you know? I mean, and it's a little, I think he has to almost bite the bullet and say yes, because like Jacques Prévert knows that he's collecting matchboxes, right? Like,
sure.
Like so I think you kind of can consciously decide to sublimate, but I don't think you could take that too far, because your original desire for the thing is unconscious,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It has to be.
It has to be. I mean,
like you can't say, "Oh, I'm going to sublimate." I don't know. Like, I hate mayonnaise. I'm going to sublimate mayonnaise. I'm just going to make myself think that it's dust. I mean, I couldn't do that, right?
Yeah. As a conscious project.
I think there is an element of the unconscious that prevails, even though when you're doing the working it out, I think you do it consciously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's correct.
Like collection. I mean, collection is, wouldn't he say it's maybe the great example of sublimation?
Yeah, and Mari writes about that as well in Call of Character. Yeah, can you say more about that? What do you mean when
you say
collection?
Yeah, just because you're taking an object. I mean, it's an interesting, I think it's tempting to think of collection as a species of capitalist accumulation. But I think mm-hmm. the whole point in collection is you take objects out of circulation, right? Like you don't care about their exchange value. You actually, you want them because you don't want to exchange them. And that's why I when I was a little kid, my grandfather was a great alcoholic. He drank all the time. And as a favor to me, I had a beer can collection, and he would buy different kinds. He didn't care what kind of beer he drank. It was all just like water as to you and me. He drank a case of beer every day and like a pint of whiskey. I mean, I now think about that and I'm kind of awed by it. It's just an incredible.
That reminds me of what Coach says about Sam Malone in the pilot episode of Cheers. Is like, he was the best ball player ever, there's the joke with Coach is that he's always referring to a slightly different thing from, like, this is always the joke. And so he says he was the best ball player, and then Sam says, "Oh yeah, I was a good pitcher or whatever, but a terrible drunk." And then he says, "He was a terrific drunk." Like, you never saw a drunk this, like, anyway, like, he's complimenting for that as well. Anyway.
That's funny. Anyway, my grandfather would buy all these different kinds of beer. He didn't care. And so I had this beer can collection, which I kept. I kept at my mom's house. And then when she moved, Hillary organized it. It was in our attic. And so she's like, "Let's get rid of those. They probably have a lot of value now." So a guy comes over. She like looks it up in the, I don't know where you look up beer online, whatever. Some guy comes over, he's like, "I'll appraise it and then maybe I'll buy it or some." And the guy comes over, he goes, "Well, all these cans are worthless. There's one that's maybe worth $1. I'll give you $1 for it." I was like, "You got to be kidding me. Like, I had these cans. I've like trucked them from Ohio. I had them in Texas. This is incredible." But I thought it was a perfect expression of the valuelessness of the collection to capital. You know, the capital, it's just like, it's worth $1 or whatever. Like, it's nothing. And I think that that's the value of the collection. Benjamin makes this point I think it's called Unpacking My Library, his essay on collecting. He says, mm-hmm. like once the collector dies, the value of the collection disappears.
Yeah.
Walter Benjamin. Right? Like and I think his point is really Lacan's point, that it's the act of sublimation that gives the collection its value. So that's why I think really collection, it's even better than Courtly Love is the example, I think, for sublimation, just because of the way it takes something out of circulation, out of what Lacan will call the service of goods. Right? Mm. Like, what a great term he has there that he invents basically here.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it does we were talking about this, right? It does kind of the opposite of what I think people normally do with the, like, so you play, so a play on the word goods, right? Like, right. Goods is in beer cans. You know, your thing reminded me, when I was at UVM, it was impossible to find this beer called Heady Topper.
And people, I know that.
Yeah. Okay, and now
people would line up to get it.
People would, like, they had to start moving the trucks. This was so funny. They had the name of the beer company was The Alchemist, and they had to start having unlabeled, like, vans taking the beer to the liquor stores because everyone knew to follow them. But then everyone knew to follow the unlabeled trucks. It was.
Did it work?
Yeah, it did work. It totally did. But outside of that, people would sell like empty cans on eBay for like $12. I couldn't understand. But it was like, yeah. So even having the can, the pristine finished can, it's got nice artwork, I guess, on it. Worth something. But so maybe we can read a little bit of that into Lacan's intervention here. But like goods as in that which we exchange, right, and the sovereign good.
Yeah, that's right, Ryan. So it's really interesting because I think most people don't connect those, like sovereign good, like good of God. What does God have to do with the wares, the commodities that we're buying, right? But Lacan makes the connection here, which is with this service of goods, which is, I just think it's an incredible intervention and an idea, really, that just, and he draw again, another one that he never says service of goods again after 7R7. So if you like that concept and you want to read more about it in Lacan, sorry.
That's
like,
it.
You know, you can't.
No, that it's, so we're, how do we want to proceed? Because there was a thing, on Death Drive he never really says again.
Yeah, I think we need to talk about that because that's a really, again, like, what's the link between Das Ding and Death Drive and God only knows, but he does come to, he articulates a notion of Death Drive here, linking to Sod. And I think I think in his mind, this is all part of this like ethics of like going beyond the limit. Right. Mm-hmm. And he will say later, Antigone goes beyond the limit of what he calls ate, which is a Greek word for the idea of a beyond. Right. So she goes beyond this limit. And I think that's maybe what all these things have in common, right? That sublimation, dusting, Death Drive. He'll later talk about jouissance of transgression, right? Like he's linking, and this seminar is much more linked to a thinker like Georges Bataille, who. Interestingly, Lacan married Bataille's ex-wife, Lacan's second wife. It's not exactly at this time, but a little bit earlier. So he clearly knew Bataille's thought, and Bataille was really big into, there was this rumor going around that Bataille had been involved in a human sacrifice, and the rumor was perpetuated by Georges Bataille. Right? Like he loved this idea, but he identified enjoyment, jouissance with pure expenditure, right? He's pretty interesting as a thinker. I think he's worth dipping into, not devoting oneself to, but certainly dipping into. But I think that there's what Lacan is getting at is that like Bataille, like they're like going beyond the limit is enjoyment. Going beyond the is jouissance. Going beyond that's what Death Drive does too. That it's going beyond the limit, and it's the limit of the good. And so Death Drive means total annihilation, right? And that's what he likes. He gets this idea of, he links Death Drive to Sod, right? This and the destruction of the whole natural world, and but he then says it's destroyed in order to restart again.
Yeah.
So that's why it's drive, right? It's this repetition of like destroy everything, start again.
Can I give the line?
Yeah.
Also, I like that you made Bataille sound like Ozzy Osbourne. So that's like, that's pretty. That's,
no,
I think there,
no,
it's
Ozzy Osbourne is Bataille, he's a Batailleist. That is true. Absolutely true.
It's okay. So this is on 212. If everything that is immanent, that's immanent, or implicit in the chain, bring this up so I can speak into the mic better. If everything that is imminent or implicit in the chain of natural events may be considered as subject to the so-called death drive, it is only because there is a signifying chain. Freud's thought in this matter requires that what is involved be articulated as a destruction drive, given that it challenges everything that exists, but it is also a will to create from zero, a will to begin again.
Yeah. Isn't it, I think a lot of... I don't want to pick on certain, but a lot of like leftists that I know, mm-hmm. I don't want to say Marxists, but a lot of leftists I know believe this, right? Like, mm-hmm. like it has to get much worse for it to get better. Like we need to start again at zero. Let's like tear it all down and then start again. Like, I think that that's I find this an abhorrent kind of ethic, and I think it's like theoretically completely misguided, but I think that, and I think it's a terrible reading of Death Drive. Like, this is a point where I fundamentally think Lacan is just wrong and bad. This is just bad. Like, I'm just against, right? Like, I think like that, I don't think that's ever, like, I don't think that's what Freud means by Death Drive. I think Sod should not be instructive for us in almost any way, right? Other than, you know, I don't know, no way really, except as like to understand perversion. I don't know. What's your feeling about this? Maybe I'm reacting too strongly.
I mean, the kink shaming that you just did was just out of control. No, I'm kidding. I think your reading's probably right about the extremity to which that he's going, but it's my thing, and it's okay. My thing with the drive that I don't see very often is Alenka maybe it is probably the closest here, where you know, she has this line about like the death drive. She tries to emphasize, I think this is in What Is Sex, like the creative aspect of it. It's this thing that makes us die differently, like this thing that,
yeah,
you know, because she does a lot of good work in that book, like sussing out these how could we say, like, there's a, what is the eros involved in this, like, so she has right. a really good, I think, a good take right. on that. So my the ex nihilo and the zero point thing, I think I'll give you the territory on. What I would want to keep from this, though, is that I think that there's precious little writing on the drive that has this idea of a generation of the new. And I think there's a lot that is wrapped up in this kind of perpetual undermining repetition, which is of course there, but it is this idea that it always brings us back to some, as Freud writes in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, an original state of loss. And I think that as a dialectical principle,
you like that.
Because I think it's this, it's like, I gave this example to someone, is that like, if you, look, if you're playing, I had this conversation with a former student who got into grad school somewhere, and she was just like terrified of it, of the whole thing of success. And she quoted me this this line from Seinfeld, where it's in the season where George and Jerry are writing. It's the one where everyone gets the Seinfeld is a show about nothing from, because that's how they define the show to NBC, when Jerry gets asked to write a sitcom on the sitcom, the meta season of it, when really the way they pitched the show in real life was, it's about how a comedian gets his material. That's how it is. Not they pitched it as a show about nothing. Anyway.
Okay.
So the show is going to go ahead, and George goes to his therapist, and he tells her all this like good news. And she says, that's amazing. She's like, and he's like, I'm just completely ridden with anxiety and unhappy about it. And she's like, why? She's like, everything's going on for you. And he says, God won't let me be happy. And then she says, but you don't believe in God. And he says, well, I do for the bad things. And so what I was saying is like I understood what she was saying. And I said, like, I would kind of bring this back more to the way that the death drive works, right. Is that like we're always undermining ourselves, and it's a lot more it's a failure unless it's embarrassing, but just like minimal, mundane, like everyday failure, way easier to deal with than success.
Much easier to deal with.
So much easier to deal with.
Yeah.
The, you know, the little stumble, the hitch of the everyday, like the missaid thing, so much easier than like you really nailed something. And I think it's a little bit like, so the way that the drive works, this was the example I gave to her. It's a little, do you know the arcade game Dance Dance Revolution? Do you know this thing?
No.
Okay, so it's like there'd be there's like a game pad on the floor, and it tells you you have to step on a
button
on the floor. You understand it. Yeah, okay. You've seen it.
Yeah.
And so the drive is like, okay, you have to play Dance Dance Revolution, but you're blindfolded. And so if you do that, you're not going to be able, you're just like throwing your limbs, you know, wildly at the floor, and you're not going to get it.
Right.
But that does inhere in it the possibility that you might actually do it right. Like you might actually nail it at some point. If you're just doing it like willy-nilly and you don't know what you're doing, you may actually end up look like you know what you're doing. And that is way more terrifying than the failure part. That is much more secure. So this is kind of how I think, like the drive, I think you can undermine yourself into a relationship you're not ready for, a friendship you're not ready for, a job opportunity you're not ready for, a conversation you're not ready for. Like, and I that's what I think is a dimension of the drive that isn't explored enough. And I so that is an aspect that I think is in here that I would,
that's pretty good,
that I would keep.
I'm totally with you on that. I love that point. Yeah, I love that point. I think that's really good. I think it's interesting though that it's something that he abandons, right?
Like
when we get to seminar 11, we'll get to another notion of death drive. So it undergoes these incredible, like there was an identification of death drive with symbolic order in seminar 2. Mm. Then here there's this identification of death drive with the total destruction of the symbolic.
Yeah.
And then in seminar 11, it'll be about this hitch of the real within the symbolic and the encounter, the continued missed encounter, which is what you just described as normal everyday life, right?
Become,
it's interesting that like that will become the way that he understands death drive as this thing that organizes our normal everyday life. So that, I think that's that I do see the appeal of this period I think you're right about that. That seems really good. And I think that you can also maybe see the connection to Antigone, right? And what he finds fecund about Antigone, that she, like, it's not just a purely destructive act, but also an act that, like, can we find all the things earlier in the seminar in this act, right? Like, that's the puzzle that Lacan leaves, because, again, he doesn't do it. Like, there's not, like, oh, as I've shown here, now this is sublimation and this is, here's where Das Ding emerges. And no, he says that Antigone has a splendor about her. Mm-hmm. And so some people read it as she's the sublime. She's been elevated by Lacan, I guess. I just don't think that's right. I think that there's something in what Antigone herself does that is the act of sublimation, and that follows the death drive, and that creates a Das Ding, right? Like, doesn't she turn Polynices into Das Ding through her act of sublimating, which is, interestingly, putting dirt on top of him.
Yeah,
like, creating a vase or creating an absence there where his body was lying. And I think that is the act of sublimation. And I think it is on her part, a destructive act relative to the whole symbolic. But then doesn't Lacan say, I mean, according to what you're saying about death drive, right? That there's this emergence of the new. Mm. And I think the emergence of the new is precisely the value of Polynices himself, the value of the singularity of the subject itself, right? Like he was devalued. He didn't, he fought against his society, right? So it's like, remember that when the Taliban attacked and there was that one American that went and fought for the Taliban?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that guy? Like,
I do.
Like, that's who Polynices is, basically, right? Like, he fought for against the, he fought, he's like the ultimate traitor, right? Mm-hmm. So leaving him unburied seems like, I don't know, it doesn't seem, I think from our perspective, we're like, why should we bury him?
Mm-hmm.
But Antigone goes through this whole justification. Remember this, Lacan makes a big deal out of this. Mm-hmm. Like that if it was my spouse, I could get another spouse. If it was a child, I could just have another child.
Sure.
But it's my brother and my parents are dead, so I can't replace him.
Mm-hmm.
And Lacan loves that all these commentators are like, Like, I think, is it Goethe? Doesn't he quote Goethe saying, I hope someday somebody will find that this was just a later interpolation, that Sophocles didn't write this. And Aristotle goes, oh, it's too bad that these, and in fact, to prove Lacan's point even more, in the, I forget who did it, but in a translation of the Oedipus trilogy that I initially had, I forgot, I wish I remember who did it. They just edited out the lines. And there's a footnote, and it's like in verses that are as like bad in form as they are in content. Sophocles did said this, but we don't think he could have possibly wrote it, so we left it out of the play. Funny. And you're like, oh my god, it's exactly Lacan's point. So anyway, so I think that there's something about that's what's created. Right, is the singularity of Polynesis that doesn't just exist on its own, but exists through Antigone's act of her act of sublimating.
So here's my question, and this will be the question for this last stage of the seminar and the last stage of our podcast. Yes. Can a social be sustained if everyone is acting in accordance with the ethics of psychoanalysis as Lacan lays it out here, that one should not give ground, not giving ground relative to one's desire is the ethical position of psychoanalysis. Can a social be, because that this would be, I mean, that's a huge thing that Kant is concerned with, for example, is that's the categorical imperative, right? Like how do we sustain this thing? In very plain terms is acting in such a way that if everyone acted this way, it would the world would be in a better place, right? Yes. Like that's just to put it in very plain terms. So this is not that. And I mean that he has good, and it's the surely there's the Saad influence. Surely there's the death drive influence. The way that he understands it here, surely there's the inflammation of the sublimation, right? That influence here, what he wants to say about dusting, all of those things,
right?
I totally see in alignment, kind of actually just as how you laid it out. But I think it is threatening to the way that he's trying to marry the theoretical and practical projects of Kant here. Yeah, and I don't know if that circle gets squared. So. What do you think of all that?
It's a great question. You know, it's funny. I used to have people would say to me, okay, ethics of desire, but what about the social fabric? How it's going to destroy that? And I'd be like, oh, you just don't understand Lacan. That's stupid. But as I've gotten older, I now think like, well, that's not a terrible question actually, because I think it's tied to the conception of jouissance as transgression, right? Yeah. I'm sorry, but for me, Tony Soprano is not a figure of jouissance, right? I'm sorry. He's not. Like, he's a figure of pathetic conformity. And I think this is a really important flaw in this seminar, that I think the criminal is really much more, I don't mean the criminal, maybe I don't need to say this, but I don't mean the criminal that steals bread because they're starving to death, right? Like, I mean the Tony Soprano criminal who could, whatever, they could go out and get a real job, but they just don't. Or the person that just stole my identity and walked into a bank and tried to take all the money out of my account. I didn't tell you about that. But anyway,
oh my God. So that you criminal. Tell me that after, Jesus.
Yeah, so I just said I was talking to our bank person. I'm like, wouldn't it have been easier? Like, they made a whole ID of my thing, and I said, wouldn't it have been easier just to get a job? They could have been easier than stealing my ID. Like, they had to go through a lot. But I don't think of that figure as a figure of radicality, and I also think of that figure as much more of a conformist. Mm. And I think Tony Soprano here is very illustrative. Right, like he's more of a conformist than the person getting his garbage is a bad example because they're owned by the mom, but like the person cleaning his house, right? Like he's much more, because he's so much committed. He's using crime as a vehicle to do all the things. Like, he wants to treat women a certain way. He wants to have a bunch of nice commodities, right? He wants to do all that kind of crap that's just like utter conformity. Mm. So I think that Lacan makes a grave, on this account, grave error to think that the criminal is in some way radical, right? And I think that, to me, that's where the rubber hits the road in this seminar. Like, I can't get around that idea. Although I think if you want to think of it in the best way, and tell me if you can imagine a society of people like this. So, you know this Michael Mann, his first real feature after the incredible TV movie Jericho Mile, which is just, I don't know, it's one of the best. It was made in a prison, shot in the prison. It's one of the great films of like, of sport. It's one of the great sports films ever made, I think.
Yeah.
Made for TV movie. Yeah, it's just, it's incredible. Yeah. Yeah. But then he made this film Thief. Have you seen Thief?
I have not.
Okay. So Thief, played by James Caan, he's a thief.
Speaking of mafia, you know, movie and stuff like that. Yeah. Cause I mean,
I know. Okay, it's after that. So he had, he was picking him because he was picking Sonny Corleone. Mm-hmm. So James Caan plays this thief who gets himself, indebted to the local mobster, right? Who ends up controlling his life, and like he determines the jobs that James Caan's going to go on, and he even gets him like a spouse and a kid and like his whole and a nice house and a car dealership. He gets him everything, right? And then at the end of the film, like then he controls his life, and at the end of the film, James Caan's like, I'm tired of he doesn't want to be under control anymore. The guy won't let him retire. And he's like, okay, you won't let me retire? He kills the guy, kills all the guy's henchmen, burns down his garage or car dealership, burns up his own house, sends his wife and his kid away to her mother's house, and then just drives away. Like he basically just like destroys his entire life.
Yeah.
Right. And to me, that's like, it's a great film. And it's remember in Heat where Neil McCauley, Robert De Niro says, if I can't walk away from anything in 30 seconds or less, I'm too attached to it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
This is like Thief really realizes that. Like he really De Niro couldn't do it in Heat, right? But in Thief, he really does it. And it's a really, could you imagine a world of that kind of James Caan figure, like that kind of ethic? I mean, if we think of Jericho Mile, I think you could, right? And that's maybe similar. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could talk about both, but go ahead.
No, it's a lot. So a couple things that are interesting. One of the things that Tony Soprano says about himself and about his business is he says that they're all soldiers. So like so he actually doesn't think he's committing crimes because it's like war. And that, so which leaves out the idea of war crimes, of course. And that consideration, but that's how he says it, is that like it's you sign up to be like you're part of the game. You know, The Wire kind of does a little bit too, like when you're part of the game, like, you know, the game is the game. When you're part of the game, you're in the game. Like, that's it. You're fair game. Anybody can kill you for any reason whatsoever. It's like that's it. The only thing that could protect your life would be you have relationships with other people that your death would be awkward for the person who killed, you know what I mean? Like that's kind of it. To go to Antigone, like, is she not, again, like if you want to talk about, and I said we weren't going to pull this thing, so this is slightly different than her believing she's following the unwritten rules of the gods. You could also read like she's extending like the dispensation and the complete like eradication of social norms that occurs with war. Like she's extending a war, like wartime ethics past the time that when the war is over. So it's
so what you would say is Antigone is her ethic is war by another means, right?
Yeah, right. Or it's look, this is the terror and the horror of what you wrought, and you want it to be, you're saying it's over now, and I'm like showing you what is not over. So either way, and with all of this that you've kind of what you've laid out, I think what the problem is, and I think this would be Kant's problem, or it's the Kantian problem that Lacan doesn't get at. Although he makes it clear that he's departing from Kant's examples of morality. So maybe that
right. Although maybe it is a problem for Kant too.
Okay. Well,
right? Is there a kind of way in which if you follow the Kantian moral law, you're going to be a social problem?
That's interesting.
There is that, but I think that's a more interesting thing than Lacan's, because Lacan's is just like, is transgression a social problem?
And so I think my issue here is like, doesn't it take for granted the always already substance of the social and society as such? Yeah. And it's like, because it can't be like in your example of thief. Like, again, like if everyone did that, there would be nothing. Like we'd be in, and you'd be in the middle of a Mad Max movie or something. Like that's kind of where we would.
Yeah. Ryan, I really like the point that somebody has to, like, for Lacan's theory to work, somebody has to be responsible for the good, right?
Yeah.
Somebody else has to play the heavy.
Sure.
Right? Like how is that fair? Like you get to follow your ethics of desire, but it's only because a lot of other people aren't.
Yeah.
And I just think that's an unacceptable philosophy, right? Like that's just I just don't think that that's a, like you can only have transgression if a lot of people aren't transgressing.
Yes, of course.
Right. This is a fact. Yeah. Right. This is a fact. Yeah. So
on that status quo to underwrite the transgressiveness of whatever it is that you happen to be doing.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's so interesting that he makes what I think is this really fundamental error, because it's the error of the hysteric, right? Like the hysteric, like, transgresses, but needs that, like, is relying on this structure of mastery that it's constantly like fantasizing about transgressing. Mm-hmm. Same with perversion, right? Like the psychoanalysis, that's all it deals with. Mm-hmm. Are these figures, these subjects that need the authority that they can't subjectively recognize that they need.
Yeah.
Right. That they're relying on this authority that they don't realize they rely on. So I think it's an odd error. And I think it is the influence of Bataille. And I think what's interesting is that this is such an influential part of his doctrine, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's just so, this don't give ground relative to one's desire is, or how does he put it exactly? The only thing that one can be guilty of is having given ground relative to one's desire.
Right.
That's the exact quotation, because people get upset if you're not quoting it exactly. They're like, oh, Lacan never said don't give ground relative to your desire. Well, okay. He basically did say that. So, okay. I just quoted it exactly. So, I feel like it's a kind of error. I think you're right. But let's go to the Jericho Mile example.
I want to phrase it this way, and then we can go what you just said. Like, it's kind of a thing, you were saying about like how convinced you were of this, and then sort of like later, not so much. In a sort of a separate way, like I was very for a while, like really very very convinced by the Bartlebyan ethics that Zizek is. I think it has its best expression in a book he wrote in Parallax View, which is the turning the figure of Bartleby, the Scrivener, the Herman Melville short story. I would prefer not to, like, making that an ethical position under Capital. And I'm gonna say this was something that struck me years later. So, you know, this is the example, just like you, I was so much older then and I'm younger than that now. So what happened was I just thought, what if my boss did that though? Like, and think about the ethical, like the only thing one can be guilty of is not giving ground relative to one's desire. What if your boss did that? I think it's something that, like, again, there is this implicit need of a substantial structure to exist to underwrite this transgressive act. And just think, what if the person in authority did that? Also, they are already doing that. That's the whole problem, actually, is that there's not a higher there's no higher for the people who are above you in pay grade. There is not a higher a law or good that they are, you know, adhering to, and that and so that that's, so this idea, I was just thinking about this, like, again, it's like, does it work if the person in authority does it too? Is it still ethical? And I think we say no. And then I think,
yeah, we say no.
Right. That's, and I think that becomes a problem.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, you know what we're doing? It's a Hegelian critique of Kant, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing. Like, it's he's a Kantian here, and we're saying, and Kant always thinks from this position of the isolated subject, right? Like, that's the reason why his morality ends up having a problem when it tries to think about the social order, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Hegel does the opposite, right? Like, he thinks about the subjectivity and its individuality, its singularity from the perspective of the collective. So I think that it's for him, this would be incredibly problematic. And I think for the reason, like, you're relying on someone else to do the Steely Dan song, right? I'd be a fool to do your dirty work, but that's what Lacan wants. He wants somebody else, please do, like, Lacan basically is giving this seminar. He's like, please don't everyone listen to me, right? Like, and I just think that cannot be that is not, like, Hegel even says in the Sense Certainty chapter of the Phenomenology of Spirit, right? Like, he says, look, once you make a claim, you're making a universalist claim. Sorry. Like, you may not think you are, but you are. And I think that's the contradiction at the heart of this seminar. And I think it's all tied to this emphasis on transgression that gets, all these things we're talking about. And I think some of the things, as we've said, are great, but I think that this really hampers it. Can you answer my question though about the Jericho Mile? Like, is that an envisionable world? So just to tell a little bit about what happens at the end of the film, and then
no, you do it. You set it up.
Okay,
you have the angle. So I don't want to leave.
So there's a guy who's in prison, and he's a fast runner. Right, he runs all the time every day, and he's gonna. What is the race? Is it the 400 or I can't remember. I think it's the 400 that he's going to try to qualify for the Olympics, and they do a trial in the prison. And it turns out that why does he refuse? It ends up that the somebody rules against him that he can't go. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so he ends up in frustration seeing they run the Olympic race. He gets the winning time. And then he times himself. He goes out to the track. They build a track in the prison. He goes out to the track, times himself, and he bests the winning time. And then the end of the film is him throwing the stopwatch away. Like, he's not, doesn't even want a record of it, right? So I don't know. I feel like that, and I think there's something, it's not exactly like Thief, but there's this refusal of the social recognition, right? That I think is a little that's different than the tearing down.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I think that for Jericho Mile, reading it in this way, I think it refuses. Okay, I put it this way: it refuses the the social, but in a way that doesn't. I think it doesn't rely on it for substance, because where it's coming from, it's a better example. If this is what Lacan is trying to get at, is that, like, we're looking at,
it would work, wouldn't it?
It would totally works, because I think, because
he rejects the good, right?
Yeah, exactly.
He rejects the good.
Yeah. and it ends up being this more subjective, this more, like, I don't know, I guess more personal thing
He doesn't need a bad guy, right?
He doesn't need a bad guy. I think you just used the right word. It refuses the recognition of the social, but whereas what Antigone does actually needs the recognition of it.
It kind of does, doesn't it? Like, it needs to parade its refusal of recognition.
Yeah. Right? In the same way James Caan does too.
He needs that mobster to see that he's killing him.
Yeah.
Right.
And Tony Soprano needs, I think, Melfi to see him, but not see him. Yeah. Although he does have the great line. It's unfortunate that he says subconscious, but he does say to her that I know now too much of the, of the subconscious, like to, yeah. And this is with when Christopher makes the movie where there's a bad guy played by, is it, which of it's a Baldwin. I'm forgetting which is it Steven.
Yeah.
But he plays, so he plays that, someone who looks just like Tony,
Yeah.
And it's a clear, it's a clear critique, and she's trying to make him feel better about it. And he says, I know too much now about the subconscious. And it's a perfect, it's actually a perfect read of the unconscious. It's just said in the, you know, not in the way, not in the way we would validate, because it implies an over and a mastery and a kind of control. But
that's
anyway,
right.
So to just go back to the point is like what you can't say, I guess I'd say this, what you can't say is that Antigone is beyond the recognition of the state, nor even beyond the recognition of the gods. And you also can't say that in your thief example, the James Caan character is beyond the recognition of the people he's doing the violence and the damage to. Whereas I do think in the Jericho Mile example, it's like you've reached a beyond the necessity of that recognition, meaning that authority can exist, the substantial authority can exist or it cannot exist, but where the meaning and the radicality comes from it is it's more internal, it's not external.
Yeah.
I think that's the change that would be.
You got to read Lacan with Jericho Mile and not with Thief. I think that's he didn't have the right example.
He didn't have the right. Yeah. Yeah. That happens.
It hadn't been made yet. He had time though. He had like 2 years before he died, or I don't know, three. He could have maybe gone back to it. But he didn't.
You know, what is it?
I guess the lesson is obvious, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. We got to watch Jericho Mile. He mentions that I was going to say that he mentions the Marx Brothers in this, and as opposed to most people, he acknowledges Zeppo. He says four Marx Brothers.
He does.
He doesn't say three. I was thinking about like that. That's maybe the earliest anticipation of him going to the four discourses. And then it made me realize this. You know, the capitalist discourse, which I do like, but that becomes the Gummo discourse.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Ryan, there's your next your next paper, because Gummo he worked as an agent. Do you know that?
Yes. No, I don't think I knew that.
No. So he really was a capitalist. Like it really, it's like perfect actually.
Sometimes we transcend ourselves, Tommy Gowen.
Yeah. All right. Over and out, man.
Over and out, Todd.